This audio program is presented by Audible.com. Audible. Audio that speaks to you wherever you are.
Hachette Digital presents The Player of Games by Ian M. Banks. Read by Peter Kenny. Part 1. Culture Plate. This is the story of a man who went far away for a long time just to play a game. The man is a game player called Gergye. The story starts with a battle that is not a battle, and ends with a game that is not a game. Me? I'll tell you about me later. This is how the story begins. Dust drifted with each footstep. He limped across the desert, following the suited figure in front. The gun was quiet in his hands. They must be nearly there. The noise of distant surf boomed through the helmet sound field. They were approaching a tall dune from which they ought to be able to see the coast. Somehow, he had survived. He had not expected to. It was bright and hot and dry outside, but inside the suit he was shielded from the sun and the baking air, cosseted and cool. One edge of the helmet visor was dark, where it had taken a hit, and the right leg flexed awkwardly, also damaged, making him limp. But otherwise he'd been lucky. The last time they'd been attacked had been a kilometre back, and now they were nearly out of range. The flight of missiles cleared the nearest ridge in a glittering arc. He saw them late because of the damaged visor. He thought the missiles had already started firing, but it was only the sunlight reflecting on their sleek bodies. The flight dipped and swung together like a flock of birds. When they did start firing, it was signalled by strobing red pulses of light. He raised his gun to fire back. The other suited figures in the group had already started firing. Some dived to the dusty desert floor, others dropped to one knee. He was the only one standing. The missiles swerved again, turning all at once and then splitting up to take different directions. Dust puffed around his feet as shots fell close. He tried to aim at one of the small machines, but they moved startlingly quickly, and the gun felt large and awkward in his hands. His suit chimed over the distant noise of firing and the shouts of the other people. Lights winked inside the helmet, detailing the damage. The suit shook, and his right leg went suddenly numb. "Wake up, Gergye!" Ye laughed alongside him. She swiveled on one knee as two of the small missiles swung suddenly at their section of the group, sensing that was where it was weakest. Gergye saw the machines coming, but the gun sang wildly in his hands, and he seemed always to be aiming at where the missiles had just been. The two machines darted for the space between him and Ye. One of the missiles flashed once and disintegrated. Ye shouted, exulting. The other missile swung between them. She lashed out with her foot, trying to kick it. Gergye turned awkwardly to fire at it, accidentally scattering fire over Ye's suit as he did so. He heard her cry out and then curse. She staggered, but brought the gun round. Fountains of dust burst around the second missile as it turned to face them again, its red pulses lighting up his suit and filling his visor with darkness. He felt numb from the neck down, and crumpled to the ground. It went black and very quiet.
"You are dead," a crisp little voice told him.
He lay on the unseen desert floor. He could hear distant muffled noises, sense vibrations from the ground. He heard his own heart beat and the ebb and flow of his breath. He tried to hold his breathing and slow his heart, but he was paralyzed, imprisoned, without control. His nose itched. It was impossible to scratch it. "What am I doing here?" he asked himself. Sensation returned. People were talking, and he was staring through the visor at the flattened desert dust a centimetre in front of his nose. Before he could move, somebody pulled him up by one arm. He unlatched his helmet. Ye Meristinu, also bareheaded, stood looking at him and shaking her head. Her hands were on her hips. Her gun swung from one wrist. "You were terrible," she said, though not unkindly. She had the face of a beautiful child, but the slow, deep voice was knowing and roguish, a low-slung voice. The others sat around on the rocks and dust, talking. A few were heading back to the clubhouse. Ye picked up Gergye's gun and presented it to him. He scratched his nose, then shook his head, refusing to take the weapon. "Ye," he told her, "this is for children." She paused, slung her gun over one shoulder, and shrugged, and the muzzles of both guns swung in the sunlight, glinting momentarily, and he saw the speeding line of missiles again and was dizzy for a second.
"So," she said, "it isn't boring. You said you were bored. I thought you might enjoy a shoot."
He dusted himself down and turned back toward the clubhouse. Ye walked alongside. Recovery drones drifted past them, collecting the components of the destructed machines.
"It's infantile, Ye. Why fritter your time away with this nonsense?"
They stopped at the top of the dune. The low clubhouse lay 100 meters away between them and the golden sand and snow-white surf. The sea was bright under the high sun.
"Don't be so pompous," she told him.
Her short brown hair moved in the same wind which blew the tops from the falling waves and sent the resulting spray curling back out to sea. She stooped to where some pieces of a shattered missile lay half buried in the dune, picked them up, blew sand grains off the shining surfaces, and turned the components over in her hands.
"I enjoy it," she said. "I enjoy the sort of games you like, but I enjoy this too."
She looked puzzled.
"This is a game. Don't you get any pleasure from this sort of thing?"
"No, and neither will you after a while." She shrugged easily.
"Till then."
She handed him the parts of the disintegrated machine. He inspected them while a group of young men passed, heading for the firing ranges.
"Mr. Gerge?"
One of the young males stopped, looking at Gerge quizzically. A fleeting expression of annoyance passed across the older man's face, to be replaced by the amused tolerance Ye had seen before in such situations.
"Gernau Morat, Gerge?"
the young man said, still not quite sure.
"Guilty."
Gerge smiled gracefully and, Ye saw, straightened his back fractionally, drawing himself up a little. The younger man's face lit up. He executed a quick, formal bow. Gerge and Ye exchanged glances.
"An honor to meet you, Mr. Gerge,"
the young man said, smiling widely.
"My name's Shuro. I'm..."
He laughed.
"I follow all your games. I have a complete set of your theoretical works on file."
Gerge nodded. "How comprehensive of you."
"Really, I'd be honored if any time you're here you'd play me at, well, anything. Deploy is probably my best game. I play off 3 points, but..."
"Whereas my handicap, regrettably, is lack of time," Gerge said. "But certainly, if the chance ever arises, I shall be happy to play you."
He gave a hint of a nod to the younger man.
"A pleasure to have met you."
The young man flushed and backed off, smiling.
"The pleasure's all mine, Mr. Gerge. Goodbye, goodbye."
He smiled, awkwardly, then turned and walked off to join his companions. Ye watched him go.
"You enjoy all that stuff, don't you, Gerge?"
She grinned.
"Not at all," he said briskly. "It's annoying."
Ye continued to watch the young man walking away, looking him up and down as he tramped off through the sand. She sighed.
"But what about you?"
Gerge looked with distaste at the pieces of missile in his hands.
"Do you enjoy all this destruction?"
"It's hardly destruction,"
Ye drawled. "The missiles are explosively dismantled, not destroyed. I can put one of those things back together in half an hour."
"So it's false."
"What isn't?"
"Intellectual achievement, the exercise of skill, human feeling."
Ye's mouth twisted in irony. She said,
"I can see we have a long way to go before we understand each other, Gerge."
"Then let me help you."
"Be your protege?"
"Yes."
Ye looked away to where the rollers fell against the golden beach and then back again. As the wind blew and the surf pounded, she reached slowly behind her head and brought the suit's helmet over, clicking it into place. He was left staring at the reflection of his own face in her visor. He ran one hand through the black locks of his hair. Ye flicked her visor up.
"I'll see you, Gerge. Chamlis and I are coming round to your place the day after tomorrow, aren't we?"
"If you want."
"I want."
She winked at him and walked back down the slope of sand. He watched her go. She handed his gun to a recovery drone as it passed her, loaded with glittering metallic debris. Gerge stood for a moment, holding the bits of wrecked machine. Then he let the fragments drop back to the barren sand. He could smell the earth and the trees around the shallow lake beneath the balcony. It was a cloudy night and very dark, just a hint of glow directly above, where the clouds were lit by the shining plates of the orbital's distant daylight side. Waves lapped in the darkness, loud slappings against the hulls of unseen boats. Lights twinkled round the edges of the lake, where low college buildings were set among the trees. The party was a presence at his back, something unseen, surging like the sound and smell of thunder from the faculty building. Music and laughter, and the sense of perfumes and food, and exotic, unidentifiable fumes. The rush of sharp blue surrounded him, invaded him. The fragrances on the warm night air, spilling from the line of open doors behind, carried on the tide of noise the people made, became like separate strands of air, fibres unravelling from a rope, each with its own distinct colour and presence. The fibres became like packets of soil, something to be rubbed between his fingers, absorbed, identified. There, that red-black scent of roasted meat, blood-quickening, salivatory. Tempting and vaguely disagreeable at the same time as separate parts of his brain assessed the odour. The animal root smelled fuel, protein-rich food. The midbrain trunk registered dead, incinerated cells, while the canopy of forebrain ignored both signals because it knew his belly was full and the roast meat cultivated. He could detect the sea, too. A brine smell from 10 or more kilometres away over the plain and the shallow downs, another threaded connection, like the net and web of rivers and canals that linked the dark lake to the restless flowing ocean beyond the fragrant grasslands and the scented forests. Sharp blue was a game player's secretion, a product of standard gene-affixed culture glands sitting in Gerge's lower skull, beneath the ancient, animal-evolved lower reaches of his brain. The panoply of internally manufactured drugs the vast majority of culture individuals were capable of choosing from comprised up to 300 different compounds of varying degrees of popularity and sophistication. Sharp blue was one of the least used because it brought no direct pleasure and required considerable concentration to produce. But it was good for games. What seemed complicated became simple. What appeared insoluble became soluble. What had been unknowable became obvious. A utility drug, an abstraction modifier, not a sensory enhancer or a sexual stimulant, and he didn't need it. That was what was revealed as soon as the first rush died away and the plateau phase took over. The lad he was about to play, whose previous match of four colours he had just watched, had a deceptive style, but an easily mastered one. It looked impressive, but it was mostly show. Fashionable, intricate, but hollow and delicate too, finally vulnerable. Gerge listened to the sounds of the party, and the sounds of the lake waters, and the sounds coming from the other university buildings on the far side of the lake. The memory of the young man's playing style remained clear. Dispense with it, he decided there and then. Let the spell collapse. Something inside him relaxed, like a ghost limb untensed, a mind trick. The spell, the brain's equivalent of some tiny, crude, looping sub-program, collapsed, simply ceased to be said. He stood on the terrace by the lake for a while, then turned and went back into the party.
"Here now, Gerge, I thought you'd run off."
He turned to face the small drone which had floated up to him as he re-entered the richly furnished hall. People stood talking or clustered around game boards and tables beneath the great banners of ancient tapestries. There were dozens of drones in the room too, some playing, some watching, some talking to humans, a few in the formal, lattice-like arrangements, which meant they were communicating by transceiver. Morin Skell, the drone which had addressed him, was by far the smallest of the machines present. It could have sat comfortably on a pair of hands. Its aura field held shifting tints of grey and brown within the band of formal blue. It looked like a model of an intricate and old-fashioned spacecraft. Gerge scowled at the machine as it followed him through the crowds of people to the four colours table.
"I thought perhaps this toddler had scared you," the drone said, as Gerge arrived at the young man's game table and sat down in a tall, heavily ornamented wooden chair, hurriedly vacated by his just-beaten predecessor. The drone had spoken loudly enough for the toddler concerned, a tassel-haired young man of about 30 or so, to hear. The young man's face looked hurt. Gerge sensed the people around him grow a little quieter. Morhinskell's aura fields switched to a mixture of red and brown, humorous pleasure and displeasure together, a contrary signal close to a direct insult. "Ignore this machine,"
Gergay told the young man, acknowledging his nod. It likes to annoy people. He pulled his chair in, adjusted his old, unfashionably loose and wide-sleeved jacket. I'm Geronau Gergay, and you?
Stemley Fors, the young man said, gulping a little.
Pleased to meet you. Now, what colour are you taking?
Green.
Fine. Gergay sat back. He paused, then waved at the board. Well, after you. The young man called Stemley Fors made his first move. Gergay sat forward to make his, and the drone, more in scale, settled on his shoulder, humming to itself. Gergay tapped the machine's casing with one finger, and it floated off a little way. For the rest of the match, it mimicked the snicking sound the point-hinged pyramids made as they were clicked over. Gergay beat the young man easily. He even finessed the finish a little, taking advantage of Fora's confusion to produce a pretty pattern at the end, sweeping one piece round four diagonals in a machine-gun clatter of rotating pyramids, drawing the outline of a square across the board in red, like a wound. Several people clapped, others muttered appreciatively. Gergay thanked the young man and stood up.
Cheap trick, Maureen Skell said, for all to hear. The kid was easy meat. You're losing your touch.
Its field flashed bright red, and it bounced through the air over people's heads and away. Gergay shook his head, then strode off. The little drone annoyed and amused him in almost equal parts. It was rude, insulting, and frequently infuriating, but it made such a refreshing change from the awful politeness of most people. No doubt it had swept off to annoy somebody else now. Gergay nodded to a few people as he moved through the crowd. He saw the drone, Chamlis Amalkne, by a long, low table, talking to one of the less insufferable professors. Gergay went over to them, taking a drink from a waiting tray as it floated past.
Ah, my friend, Chamlis Amalkne said.
The elderly drone was a metre and a half tall, and over half a metre wide and deep, its plain casing matte with the accumulated wear of millennia. It turned its sensing band toward him.
The professor and I were just talking about you.
Professor Boruello's severe expression translated into an ironic smile.
Fresh from another victory, Geronau Gergay?
Does it show? He said, raising the glass to his lips.
I have learned to recognize the signs, the professor said.
She was twice Gergay's age, well into her second century, but still tall and handsome and striking. Her skin was pale, and her hair was white, as it always had been, and cropped.
Another of my students humiliated?
Gergay shrugged. He drained the glass, looked round for a tray to put it on.
Allow me,
Chamlis Amalkne murmured, gently taking the glass from his hand and placing it on a passing tray a good 3 meters away. Its yellow-tinged field brought back a full glass of the same rich wine. Gergay accepted it. Boruelal wore a dark suit of soft fabric, lightened at throat and knees by delicate silver chains. Her feet were bare, which Gergay thought did not set off the outfit as, say, a pair of heeled boots might have done. But it was the most minor of eccentricities compared to those of some of the university staff. Gergay smiled, looking down at the woman's toes, tan upon the blonde wooden flooring.
You're so destructive, Gergay, Boruelal told him. Why not help us instead? Become part of the faculty instead of an itinerant guest lecturer.
I've told you, Professor, I'm too busy. I have more than enough games to play, papers to write, letters to answer, guest trips to make. And besides, I'd get bored. I bore easily, you know, Gergay said, and looked away.
Geronau Gergay would make a very bad teacher, Chamlis Amalkne agreed. If a student failed to understand something immediately, no matter how complicated and involved, Gergay would immediately lose all patience and quite probably pour their drink over them, if nothing worse.
So I've heard, the professor nodded gravely.
That was a year ago, Gergay said, frowning, and Ye deserved it. He scowled at the old drone.
Well, the professor said, looking momentarily at Chamlis, perhaps we have found a match for you, Geronau Gergay. There's a young...
Then there was a crash in the distance, and the background noise in the hall increased. They each turned at the sound of people shouting.
Not another commotion, the professor said tiredly.
Already that evening, one of the younger lecturers had lost control of a pet bird, which had gone screeching and swooping through the hall, tangling in the hair of several people before the drone, more in scale, intercepted the animal in mid-air and knocked it unconscious, much to the chagrin of most of the people at the party.
"What now?" Baruelal sighed. "Excuse me."
She absently left glass and savoury on Chamlis Amaltne's broad flat top and moved off, excusing her way through the crowd toward the source of the upheaval. Chamlis's aura flickered a displeased grey-white. It set the glass down noisily on the table and threw the savoury into a distant bin.
"It's that dreadful machine, Morin Skell," Chamlis said testily.
Gerge looked over the crowd to where all the noise was coming from.
"Really?" he said.
"What? Causing all the rumpus?"
"I don't know why you find it so appealing," the old drone said.
It picked up Boruelal's glass again and poured the pale gold wine out into an outstretched field, so that the liquid lay cupped in mid-air, as though in an invisible glass.
"It amuses me," Gerge replied. He looked at Chamlis.
"Boruelal said something about finding a match for me. Was that what you were talking about earlier?"
"Yes, it was. Some new student they've found, a GSV cabin brat with a gift for Stricken."
Gerge raised one eyebrow. Stricken was one of the more complex games in his repertoire. It was also one of his best. There were other human players in the culture who could beat him, though they were all specialists at the game, not general game players as he was. But not one of them could guarantee a win, and they were few and far between. Probably only 10 in the whole population.
"So, who is this talented infant?"
The noise on the far side of the room had lessened.
"It's a young woman," Chamlis said, slopping the field-held liquid about and letting it dribble through thin strands of hollow invisible force. "Just arrived here, came off the cargo cult, still settling in."
The general systems vehicle, Cargo Cult, had stopped off at Chark Orbital 10 days earlier and left only 2 days ago. Gerge had played a few multiple exhibition matches on the craft and been secretly delighted that they had been clean sweeps. He hadn't been beaten in any of the various games, but he hadn't played Stricken at all. A few of his opponents had mentioned something about a supposedly brilliant, though shy, young game player on the vehicle, but he or she hadn't turned up as far as Gerge knew, and he'd assumed the reports of this prodigy's powers were much exaggerated. Ship people tended to have a quaint pride in their craft. They liked to feel that even though they had been beaten by the great game player, their vessel still had the measure of him, somewhere. Of course the ship itself did, but that didn't count. They meant people. Humans, or 1.0-value drones.
"You're a mischievous and contrary device," Baruelal said to the drone Morin Skell, floating at her shoulder,
its aura field orange with well-being, but circled with little purple motes of unconvincing contrition.
"Oh," Morin Skell said brightly, "do you really think so?" "Talk to this appalling machine, Jernau Gerge," the professor said, frowning momentarily at the top of Chamlis Amalkne's casing, then picking up a fresh glass.
Chamlis poured the liquid it had been playing with into Boruelal's original glass and replaced it on the table.
"What have you been doing now?" Gerge asked Morin Skell, as it floated near his face.
"Anatomy lesson," it said,
its fields collapsing to a mixture of formal blue and brown ill-humour.
"A churlip was found on the terrace," Baruelal explained, looking accusingly at the little drone. "It was wounded. Somebody brought it in, and Morin Skell offered to treat it."
"I wasn't busy,"
Morin Skell interjected reasonably.
"It killed and dissected it in front of all the people," the professor sighed. "They were most upset."
"It would have died from shock anyway," Morin Skell said. "They're fascinating creatures, churlips. Those cute little fur folds conceal partially cantilevered bones, and the loop's digestive system is quite fascinating."
"But not when people are eating," Baruelal said, selecting another savoury from the tray. "It was still moving," she added glumly.
She ate the savoury.
"Residual synaptic capacitance," explained Morin Skell.
"Or bad taste, as we machines call it," Chamlis Amalkne said.
"An expert in that, are you, Amalkne?"
Morin Skell inquired.
"I bow to your superior talents in that field," Chamlis snapped back.
Gerge smiled. Chamlis Amalkne was an old and ancient friend. The drone had been constructed over 4,000 years ago. It claimed it had forgotten the exact date, and nobody had ever been impolite enough to search out the truth. Gerge had known the drone all his life. It had been a friend of the family for centuries. Morin Skell was a more recent acquaintance. The irascible, ill-mannered little machine had arrived on Chark Orbital only a couple of hundred days earlier, another untypical character attracted there by the world's exaggerated reputation for eccentricity. Morin Skell had been designed as a special circumstances drone for the culture's contact section, effectively a military machine with a variety of sophisticated, hardened sensory and weapon systems which would have been quite unnecessary and useless on the majority of drones. As with all sentient culture constructs, its precise character had not been fully mapped out before its construction, but allowed to develop as the drone's mind was put together. The culture regarded this unpredictable factor in its production of conscious machines as the price to be paid for individuality. But the result was that not every drone so brought into being was entirely suitable for the tasks it had initially been designed for. Morin Skell was one such rogue drone. Its personality, it had been decided, wasn't right for contact, not even for special circumstances. It was unstable, belligerent and insensitive, and those were only the grounds it had chosen to tell people it had failed on. It had been given the choice of radical personality alteration, in which it would have had little or no say in its own eventual character, or a life outside contact, with its personality intact, but its weapons and its more complex communications and sensory systems removed to bring it down to something nearer the level of a standard drone. It had, bitterly, chosen the latter, and it had made its way to Chark Orbital, where it hoped it might fit in.
"Meat brain,"
Morin Skell told Chamlis Amalknay, and zoomed off toward the line of open windows. The older drone's aura field flashed white with anger, and a bright, rippling spot of rainbow light revealed that it was using its tight-beam transceiver to communicate with a departing machine. Morin Skell stopped in mid-air, turned. Gurge held his breath, wondering what Chamlis could have said and what the smaller drone might say in reply, knowing that it wouldn't bother to keep its remarks secret, as Chamlis had.
"What I resent," it said slowly from a couple of meters away, "is not what I have lost, but what I have gained in coming, even remotely, to resemble fatigued, path-polished geriatrics like you who haven't even got the human decency to die when they're obsolete. You're a waste of matter, Amalknay."
Morin Skell became a mirrored sphere, and in that ostentatiously incommunicable mode swept out of the hall into the darkness.
"Cretinous whelp," Chamlis said, feels frosty blue.
Baruelal shrugged.
"I feel sorry for it."
"I don't," Gerge said. "I think it has a wonderful time."
He turned to the professor.
"When do I get to meet your young stricken genius? Not hiding her away to train her, are you?"
"No, we're just giving her time to adjust."
Baruelal picked at her teeth with the pointed end of the savory stick.
"From what I can gather, the girl had rather a sheltered upbringing. Sounds like she hardly left the GSV. She must feel odd being here. Also, she isn't here to do game theory, Jernal Gerge. I'd better point that out. She's going to study philosophy."
Gerge looked suitably surprised.
"A sheltered upbringing?" Chamlis Amalknay said. "On a GSV?"
Its gunmetal aura indicated puzzlement.
"She's shy."
"She'd have to be." "I must meet her," said Gerge.
"You will," Baruelal said. "Soon, maybe. She said she might come with me to Trons for the next concert. Haflis runs a game there, doesn't he?"
"Usually," Gerge agreed.
"Maybe she'll play you there, but don't be surprised if you just intimidate her."
"I shall be the epitome of gentle good grace," Gerge assured her.
Baruelal nodded thoughtfully. She gazed out over the party and looked distracted for a second, as a large cheer sounded from the center of the hall.
"Excuse me," she said. "I think I detect a nascent commotion."
She moved away. Chamlis Amalknay shifted aside to avoid being used as a table again. The professor took her glass with her.
"Did you meet Ye this morning?"
Chamlis asked Gerge. He nodded. "She had me dressed up in a suit, toting a gun and shooting at toy missiles which explosively dismantled themselves."
"You didn't enjoy it?"
"Not at all. I had high hopes for that girl, but too much of that sort of nonsense, and I think her intelligence will explosively dismantle."
"Well, such diversions aren't for everybody. She was just trying to be helpful. You'd said you were feeling restless, looking for something new."
"Well, that wasn't it," Gerge said, and felt suddenly inexplicably saddened. He and Chamlis watched as people began to move past them, heading toward the long line of windows which opened onto the terrace. There was a dull, buzzing sensation inside the man's head. He had entirely forgotten that coming down from sharp blue required a degree of internal monitoring if you were to avoid an uncomfortable hangover. He watched the people pass with a slight feeling of nausea.
"Must be time for the fireworks," Chamlis said.
"Yes. Let's get some fresh air, shall we?"
"Just what I need,"
Chamlis said, aura dully red. Gergay put his glass down, and together he and the old drone joined the flow of people spilling from the bright tapestry-hung hall onto the floodlit terrace facing the dark lake. Rain hit the windows with a noise like the crackling of the logs on the fire. The view from the house at Eichrow, down the steep wooded slope to the fjord and across it to the mountains on the other side, was warped and distorted by the water running down the glass, and sometimes low clouds flowed round the turrets and cupolas of Gergay's home like wet smoke. Ye Maristinu took a large wrought-iron poker from the hearth, and putting one booted foot up on the elaborately carved stone of the fire surround, and one pale brown hand on the rope-like edge of the massive mantelpiece, stabbed at one of the spitting logs lying burning in the grate. Sparks flew up the tall chimney to meet the falling rain. Chamlis Amalkne was floating near the window, watching the dull grey clouds. The wooden door set into one corner of the room swung open, and Gergay appeared, bearing a tray with hot drinks. He wore a loose, light robe over dark, baggy trews. Slippers made small slapping noises on his feet as he crossed the room. He put the tray down, looked at Ye.
"Thought of a move yet?"
Ye crossed over to look morosely at the game board, shaking her head.
"No," she said. "I think you've won."
"Look," Gergay said, adjusting a few of the pieces. His hands moved quickly like a magician's over the board, though Ye followed every move. She nodded.
"Yes, I see, but..."
She tapped a hex Gergay had repositioned one of her pieces on, so giving her a potentially winning formation.
"Only if I'd double-secured that blocking piece 2 moves earlier."
She sat down on the couch, taking her drink with her. Raising her glass to the quietly smiling man on the opposite couch, she said,
"Cheers to the victor."
"You almost won," Gergay told her. 44 moves. You're getting very good."
"Relatively," Ye said, drinking. "Only relatively."
She lay back on the deep couch while Gergay put the pieces back to their starting positions, and Chamlis Amalkne drifted over to float not quite between them.
"You know," Ye said, looking at the ornate ceiling, "I always like the way this house smells, Gergay."
She turned to look at the drone.
"Don't you, Chamlis?"
The machine's aura field dipped briefly to one side, a drone shrug.
"Yes, probably because the wood our host is burning is Bonis. It was developed millennia ago by the old Bavarian civilization, specifically for its fragrance when ignited."
"Yes, well, it's a nice smell,"
Ye said, getting up and going back to the windows. She shook her head.
"Sure as shit rains a lot here, though, Gergay."
"It's the mountains," the man explained. Ye glanced round, one eyebrow arched.
"You don't say."
Gergay smiled and smoothed one hand over his neatly trimmed beard.
"How is the landscaping going, Ye?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
She shook her head at the continuing downpour.
"What weather?"
She tossed her drink back.
"No wonder you live by yourself, Gergay."
"Oh, that isn't the rain, Ye," Gergay said. "That's me. Nobody can stand to live with me for long."
"He means," Chamlis said, "that he couldn't stand to live for long with anybody."
"I'd believe either,"
Ye said, coming back to the couch again. She sat cross-legged on it and played with one of the pieces on the game board.
"What did you think of the match, Chamlis?"
"You have reached the likely limits of your technical ability, but your flair continues to develop. I doubt you'll ever beat Gergay, though."
"Hey," Ye said, pretending injured pride. "I'm just a junior. I'll improve."
She tapped one set of fingernails against the other and made a tutting noise with her mouth.
"Like I'm told I will at landscaping."
"You having problems?" Chamlis said.
Ye looked as though she hadn't heard for a moment, then sighed, lay back on the couch.
"Yeah, that asshole Elrestrid and that
prissy fucking prayer ship-lail machine. They're so unadventurous. They just won't listen.
What won't they listen to?
Ideas!
Ye shouted at the ceiling.
Something different. Something not so goddamn conservative for a change. Just because I'm young, they won't pay attention.
I thought they were pleased with your work,
Chamlis said. Gergay was sitting back in his couch, swirling the drink in his glass round and just watching Ye.
Oh, they like me to do all the easy stuff, Ye said, sounding suddenly tired. Stick up a range or two, carve out a couple of lakes. But I'm talking about the overall plan, real, radical stuff. All we're doing is building just another next-door plate. Could be one of a million anywhere in the galaxy. What's the point of that?
So people can live on it,
Chamlis suggested, feels rosy.
People can live anywhere,
Ye said, levering herself up from the couch to look at the drone with her bright green eyes.
There's no shortage of plates. I'm talking about art.
What did you have in mind? Gergay asked.
How about, Ye said, magnetic fields under the base material and magnetized islands floating over oceans. No ordinary land at all. Just great floating lumps of rock with streams and lakes and vegetation and a few intrepid people. Doesn't that sound more exciting?
More exciting than what? Gergay asked.
More exciting than this!
Meristinu leapt up and went over to the window. She tapped the ancient pane.
Look at that! You might as well be on a planet. Seas and hills and rain. Wouldn't you rather live on a floating island, sailing through the air over the water?
What if the islands collide? Chamlis asked.
What if they do?
Ye turned to look at the man and the machine. It was getting still darker outside, and the room lights were slowly brightening. She shrugged.
Anyway, you could make it so they didn't. But don't you think it's a wonderful idea? Why should one old woman and a machine be able to stop me?
Well, Chamlis said, I know the Prier Shiplail machine, and if it thought your idea was good, it wouldn't just ignore it. It's had a lot of experience, and...
Yeah, Ye said, too much experience.
That isn't possible, young lady, the drone said.
Ye Meristinu took a deep breath, and seemed about to argue, but just spread her arms wide and rolled her eyes and turned back to the window.
We'll see, she said.
The afternoon, which had been steadily darkening until then, was suddenly lit up on the far side of the fjord by a bright splash of sunlight filtering through the clouds and the easing rain. The room slowly filled with a watery glow, and the house lights dimmed again. Wind moved the tops of the dripping trees.
Ah,
Ye said, stretching her back and flexing her arms.
Not to worry.
She inspected the landscape outside critically.
Hell, I'm going for a run, she announced.
She headed for the door in the corner of the room, pulling off first one boot, then the other, throwing the waistcoat over a chair and unbuttoning her blouse. You'll see. She wagged a finger at Gergay and Chamlis.
Floating islands, their time has come.
Chamlis said nothing. Gergay looked skeptical. Ye left. Chamlis went to the window. It watched the girl, down to a pair of shorts now, run out along the path leading down from the house, between the lawns and the forest. She waved once without looking back and disappeared into the woods. Chamlis flickered its fields in response, even though Ye couldn't see.
She's handsome, it said.
Gergay sat back in the couch.
She makes me feel old.
Oh, don't you start feeling sorry for yourself,
Chamlis said, floating back from the window. Gergay looked at the hearthstones.
Everything seems grey at the moment, Chamlis. Sometimes I start to think I'm repeating myself, that even new games are just old ones in disguise, and that nothing's worth playing for anyway.
Gergay,
Chamlis said, matter-of-factly, and did something it rarely did, actually settling physically into the couch, letting it take its weight.
Settle up. Are we talking about games or life?
Gergay put his dark-curled head back and laughed.
Games, Chamlis went on, have been your life. If they're starting to pall, I'd understand you might not be so happy with anything else.
Maybe I'm just disillusioned with games, Gergay said,
turning a carved game piece over in his hands. I used to think that context didn't matter. A good game was a good game, and there was a purity about manipulating rules that translated perfectly from society to society. But now, I wonder. Take this. Deploy. He nodded at the board in front of him. This is foreign. Some backwater planet discovered just a few decades ago. They play this there, and they bet on it. They make it important. But what do we have to bet with? What would be the point of my wagering Icro, say? Yay wouldn't take the bet, certainly, Chambliss said, amused. She thinks it rains too much. But you see, if somebody wanted a house like this, they'd already have had one built. If they wanted anything in the house. Gurge gestured round the room. They'd have ordered it. They'd have it. With no money, no possessions, a large part of the enjoyment the people who invented this game experienced when they played it just disappears. You call it enjoyment to lose your house, your titles, your estates, your children, maybe? To be expected to walk out onto the balcony with a gun and blow your brains out? That's enjoyment? We're well free of that. You want something you can't have, Gurge. You enjoy your life in the culture, but it can't provide you with sufficient threats. The true gambler needs the excitement of potential loss, even ruin, to feel wholly alive. Gurge remained silent, lit by the fire and the soft glow from the room's concealed lighting. You called yourself Murat when you completed your name. But perhaps you aren't the perfect game player after all. Perhaps you should have called yourself Shekui, gambler. You know, Gurge said slowly, his voice hardly louder than the crackling logs in the fire, I'm actually slightly afraid of playing this young kid. He glanced at the drone. Really? Because I do enjoy winning. Because I do have something nobody can copy, something nobody else can have. I'm me. I'm one of the best. He looked quickly, briefly up at the machine again, as though ashamed. But every now and again, I do worry about losing. I think, what if there's some kid, especially some kid, somebody younger and just naturally more talented, out there, able to take that away from me? That worries me. The better I do, the worse things get, because the more I have to lose. You are a throwback, Chambliss told him. The game's the thing. That's the conventional wisdom, isn't it? The fun is what matters, not the victory. To glory in the defeat of another, to need that purchased pride, is to show you are incomplete and inadequate to start with. Gurge nodded slowly. So they say. So everybody else believes. But not you. The man seemed to have difficulty finding the right word. I exult when I win. It's better than love, it's better than sex or any glanding. It's the only instant when I feel... He shook his head. His mouth tightened. Real, he said. Me. The rest of the time I feel a bit like that little ex-special circumstances drone, Maurin Skell, as though I've had some sort of birthright taken away from me. Ah, is that the affinity you feel? Chambliss said coldly, aura to match. I wondered what you saw in that appalling machine. Bitterness, Gurge said, sitting back again. That's what I see in it. It has novelty value, at least. He got up and went to the fire, prodding at the logs with the wrought iron poker and placing another piece of wood on, handling the log awkwardly with heavy tongs. This is not a heroic age, he told the drone, staring at the fire. The individual is obsolete. That's why life is so comfortable for us all. We don't matter, so we're safe. No one person can have any real effect anymore. Contact uses individuals, Chambliss pointed out. It puts people into younger societies who have a dramatic and decisive effect on the fates of entire meta-civilizations. They're usually mercenaries, not culture. But they're human, they're people. They're selected and used like game pieces. They don't count. Gurge sounded impatient. He left the tall fireplace, returned to the couch. Besides, I'm not one of them. So, have yourself stored until a more heroic age does arrive. Gurge said, sitting again. If it ever does. It would seem too much like cheating, anyway. The drone, Chamlis Amalkne, listened to the rain and the fire.
Well, it said slowly, if it's novelty value you want, contact, never mind SC, are the people to go to.
I have no intention of applying to join contact, Gerge said. Being cooped up in a GCU with a bunch of gung-ho do-gooders searching for barbarians to teach is not my idea of either enjoyment or fulfillment.
I didn't mean that. I meant that contact had the best minds, the most information. They might be able to come up with some ideas. Any time I've ever been involved with them, they've got things done. It's a last resort, mind you.
Why?
Because they're tricky. Devious. They're gamblers, too, and used to winning.
Gerge said, and stroked his dark beard. I wouldn't know how to go about it, he said.
Nonsense, Chamlis said. Anyway, I have my own connections there.
A door slammed.
Holy shit, it's cold out there.
Ye burst into the room, shaking herself. Her arms were clenched across her chest, and her thin shorts were stuck to her thighs. Her whole body was quivering. Gerge got up from the couch.
Come here to the fire, Chamlis told the girl.
Ye stood shivering in front of the window, dripping water.
Don't just stand there, Chamlis told Gerge. Fetch a towel.
Gerge looked critically at the machine, then left the room. By the time he came back, Chamlis had persuaded Ye to kneel in front of the fire. A bowed field over the nape of her neck held her head down to the heat, while another field brushed her hair. Little drops of water fell from her drenched curls to the hearth, hissing on the hot flagstones. Chamlis took the towel from Gerge's hands, and the man watched as the machine moved the towel over the young woman's body. He looked away at one point, shaking his head, and sat down on the couch again, sighing. Your feet are filthy, he told the girl.
Ah, it was a good run, though.
Ye laughed from beneath the towel. With much blowing and whistling and brrrr, Ye was dried. She kept the towel wrapped around her and sat, legs drawn up on the couch.
I'm famished, she announced suddenly. Mind if I make myself something to...
Let me, Gerge said. He went through the corner door, reappearing briefly to drape Ye's hide trews over the same chair she'd left the waistcoat on.
What were you talking about?
Ye asked Chamlis.
Gerge's disaffection.
Do any good?
I don't know, the drone admitted.
Ye retrieved her clothes and dressed quickly. She sat in front of the fire for a while, watching it as the day's light faded and the room lights came up. Gerge brought a tray in, loaded with sweetmeats and drinks. Once Ye and Gerge had eaten, the three of them played a complicated card game of the type Gerge liked best, one that involved bluff and just a little luck. They were in the middle of the game when friends of Ye's and Gerge's arrived, their aircraft touching down on a house lawn Gerge would rather they hadn't used. They came in, bright and noisy and laughing. Chamlis retreated to a corner by the window. Gerge played the host, keeping his guests supplied with refreshments. He brought a fresh glass to Ye, where she stood listening with a group of others to a couple of people arguing about education.
Are you leaving with this lot, Ye?
Gerge leaned back against the tapestried wall behind, dropping his voice a little, so that Ye had to turn away from the discussion to face him.
Maybe, she said slowly.
Her face glowed in the light of the fire.
You're going to ask me to stay again, aren't you?
She swirled her drink around in her glass, watching it.
No, Gerge said, shaking his head and looking up at the ceiling. I doubt it. I get bored going through the same old moves and responses.
Ye smiled.
You never know, she said. One day I might change my mind. You shouldn't let it bother you, Gerge. It's almost an honor.
You mean to be such an exception?
She drank.
I don't understand you, he told her.
Because I turn you down?
Because you don't turn anybody else down.
Not so consistently.
Ye nodded, frowning at her drink.
So, why not?
There, he had finally said it. Ye pursed her lips.
Because, she said, looking up at him, it matters to you.
Ah,
he nodded, looking down, rubbing his beard.
I should have feigned indifference.
He looked straight at her. Really, Ye. I feel you want to take me, Ye said. Like a piece, like an area, to be had, to be possessed. Suddenly she looked very puzzled.
There's something very, I don't know, primitive, perhaps, about you, Gerge. You've never changed sex, have you?
He shook his head.
Or slept with a man?
Another shake.
I thought so, Ye said. You're strange, Gerge.
She drained her glass. Because I don't find men attractive.
Yes, you're a man.
She laughed.
Should I be attracted to myself, then?
Ye studied him for a while, a small smile flickering on her face, then she laughed and looked down.
Well, not physically, anyway.
She grinned at him and handed him her empty glass. Gerge refilled it. She returned back to the others. Gerge left Ye arguing about the place of geology in culture education policy, and went to talk to Ren Meiglen, a young woman he'd been hoping would call in that evening. One of the people had brought a pet, a proto-sentient Stiglian enumerator, which padded round the room, counting under its slightly fishy breath. The slim, three-limbed animal, blonde-haired and waist-high, with no discernible head but lots of meaningful bulges, started counting people. There were 23 in the room. Then it began counting articles of furniture, after which it concentrated on legs. It wandered up to Gerge and Ren Meiglen. Gerge looked down at the animal, peering at his feet and making vague, swaying, pawing motions at his slippers. He tapped it with his toe.
Say six,
the enumerator muttered, wandering off. Gerge went on talking to the woman. After a few minutes, standing near her, talking, occasionally moving a little closer, he was whispering into her ear, and once or twice he reached round behind her to run his fingers down her spine through the silky dress she wore.
I said I'd go on with the others, she told him quietly, looking down, biting her lip, and putting her hand behind her, holding his where it rubbed at the small of her back.
Some boring band, some singer performing for everybody,
he chided gently, taking his hand away, smiling.
You deserve more individual attention, Ren.
She laughed quietly, nudging him. Eventually, she left the room and didn't return. Gerge strolled over to where Ye was gesticulating wildly and extolling the virtues of life on floating magnetic islands, then saw Chamlis in the corner, studiously ignoring the three-legged pet, which was staring up at the machine and trying to scratch one of its bulges without falling over. He shooed the beast away and talked to Chamlis for a while. Finally, the crowd of people left, clutching bottles and a few raided trays of sweetmeats. The aircraft hissed into the night. Gerge, Ye, and Chamlis finished their card game. Gerge won.
Well, I have to go, Ye said, standing and stretching. Chamlis?
Also, I'll come with you. We can share a car.
Gerge saw them to the house elevator. Ye buttoned her cloak. Chamlis turned to Gerge.
Want me to say anything to contact?
Gerge, who'd been absently looking up the stairs leading to the main house, looked puzzledly at Chamlis. So did Ye.
Oh, yes, Gerge said, smiling.
He shrugged. Why not? See what our betters can come up with. What have I got to lose? He laughed.
I love to see you happy, Ye said, kissing him lightly.
She stepped into the elevator. Chamlis followed her. Ye winked at Gerge as the door closed.
My regards to Ren, she grinned.
Gerge stared at the closed door for a moment, then shook his head, smiling to himself. He went back to the lounge, where a couple of the house remote drones were tidying up. Everything seemed back in place, as it should be. He went over to the game board, set between the dark couches, and adjusted one of the deploy pieces so that it sat in the center of its starting hexagon, then looked at the couch where Ye had sat after she had come back from her run. There was a fading patch of dampness there, dark on dark. He put his hand out, hesitantly, touched it, sniffed his fingers, then laughed at himself. He took an umbrella and went out to inspect the damage done to the lawn by the aircraft, before returning to the house, where a light in the squat main tower told that Ren was waiting for him. The elevator dropped 200 meters through the mountain, then through the bedrock underneath. It slowed to cycle through a rotate lock and gently lowered itself through the meter of ultra-dense base material to stop underneath the orbital plate in a transit gallery, where a couple of underground cars waited and the outside screens showed sunlight blazing up onto the plate base. Ye and Chamlis got into a car, told it where they wanted to go, and sat down as it unlocked itself, turned and accelerated away.
"Contact," Ye said to Chamlis.
The floor of the small car hid the sun, and beyond the side screens stars shone sharply. The car whizzed by some of the arrays of the vital but generally indecipherably obscure equipment that hung beneath every plate.
"Did I hear the name of the great benign bogey being mentioned?"
"I suggested Gerge might contact contact," Chamlis said.
It floated to a screen. The screen detached itself, still showing the view outside, and floated up the car wall until the decimeter of space its thickness had occupied in the skin of the vehicle was revealed. Where the screen had pretended to be a window was now a real window, a slab of transparent crystal with hard vacuum and the rest of the universe on the other side. Chamlis looked out at the stars.
"It occurred to me they might have some ideas, something to occupy him."
"I thought you were wary of contact."
"I am, generally. But I know a few of the minds. I still have some connections. I'd trust them to help, I think."
"I don't know," Ye said. "We're all taking this awfully seriously. He'll come out of it. He's got friends. Nothing too terrible's going to happen to him, as long as his pals are around."
"Hmm," the drone said.
The car stopped at one of the elevator tubes serving the village where Chamlis and Malkne lived.
"Will we see you in Troms?" the drone asked.
"No, I have a site conference that evening," Ye said. "And then there's a young fellow I saw at the shoot the other day. I've arranged to bump into him that night."
She grinned.
"I see," Chamlis said. "Lapsing into predatory mode, eh? Well, enjoy your bumping."
"I'll try," Ye laughed.
She and the drone bade each other good night. Then Chamlis went through the car's lock, its ancient, minutely battered casing suddenly bright in the blast of sunlight from underneath, and went straight up the elevator tube without waiting for a lift. Ye smiled and shook her head at such geriatric precocity as the car pulled away again. Wren slept on, half covered by a sheet. Her black hair spilled across the top of the bed. Gerge sat at his occasional desk near the balcony windows, looking out at the night. The rain had passed, the clouds thinned and separated, and now the light of the stars and the four plates on the far balancing side of the Chark orbital, 3 million kilometers away and with their inner faces in daylight, cast a silvery sheen on the passing clouds and made the dark fjord waters glitter. He turned on the desk pad, pressed its calibrated margin a few times until he found the relevant publications, then read for a while. Papers on game theory by other respected players, reviews of some of their games, analyses of new games and promising players. He opened the windows later and stepped out onto the circular balcony, shivering a little as a cool night air touched his nakedness. He'd taken his pocket terminal with him and braved the cold for a while, talking to the dark trees and the silent fjord, dictating a new paper on old games. When he went back in, Wren Maeglin was still asleep, but breathing quickly and erratically. Intrigued, he went over to her and crouched down by the side of the bed, looking intently at her face as it twitched and contorted in her sleep. Her breath labored in her throat and down her delicate nose, and her nostrils flared. Gerge squatted like that for some minutes, with an odd expression on his face, somewhere between a sneer and a sad smile, wondering, with a sense of vague frustration, even regret, what sort of nightmares the young woman must be having to make her quiver and pant and whimper so. The next 2 days passed relatively uneventfully. He spent most of the time reading papers by other players and theorists, and finished a paper of his own, which he'd started the night Wren Maeglin stayed. Wren had left during breakfast the next morning after an argument. He liked to work during breakfast. She'd wanted to talk. He'd suspected she was just tetchy after not sleeping well. He caught up on some correspondence. Mostly it was in the form of requests to visit other worlds, take part in great tournaments, write papers, comment on new games, become a teacher, lecturer, professor in various educational establishments, be a guest on any one of several GSVs, take on such and such a child prodigy. It was a long list. He turned them all down. It gave him a rather pleasant feeling. There was a communication from a GCU which claimed to have discovered a world on which there was a game based on the precise topography of individual snowflakes. a game which, for that reason, was never played on the same board twice. Gheorghe had never heard of such a game, and could find no mention of it in the usually up-to-date files contact collated for people like him. He suspected the game was a fake. GCUs were notoriously mischievous, but sent a considered and germane, if also rather ironic, reply, because the joke, if it was a joke, appealed to him. He watched a gliding competition over the mountains and cliffs on the far side of the fjord. He turned on the house holoscreen and watched a recently made entertainment he'd heard people talking about. It concerned a planet whose intelligent inhabitants were sentient glaciers and their iceberg children. He had expected to despise its preposterousness, but found it quite amusing. He sketched out a glacier game based on what sort of minerals could be gouged from rocks, what mountains destroyed, rivers dammed, landscapes created, and bays blocked if, as in the entertainment, glaciers could liquefy and refreeze parts of themselves at will. The game was diverting enough, but contained nothing original. He abandoned it after an hour or so. He spent much of the next day swimming in Icro's basement pool. When doing the backstroke, he dictated as well, his pocket terminal tracking up and down the pool with him, just overhead. In the late afternoon, a woman and her young daughter came riding through the forest and stopped off at Icro. Neither of them showed any sign of having heard of him, they just happened to be passing. He invited them to stay for a drink and made them a late lunch. They tethered their tall, panting mounts in the shade at the side of the house, where the drones gave them water. He advised the woman on the most scenic route to take when she and her daughter resumed their journey, and gave the child a piece from a highly ornamented Bateos set she had admired. He took dinner on the terrace, the terminal screen open and showing the pages of an ancient barbarian treatise on games. The book, a millennium old when the civilization had been contacted 2,000 years earlier, was limited in its appreciation, of course. But Gheorghe never ceased to be fascinated by the way a society's games revealed so much about its ethos, its philosophy, its very soul. Besides, barbarian societies had always intrigued him, even before their games had. The book was interesting. He rested his eyes watching the sun going down, then went back to it as the darkness deepened. The house drones brought him drinks, a heavier jacket, a light snack as he requested them. He told the house to refuse all incoming calls. The terrace lights gradually brightened. Chark's far side shone whitely overhead, coating everything in silver. Stars twinkled in a cloudless sky. Gheorghe read on. The terminal beeped. He looked severely at the camera eye set in one corner of the screen. "House," he said, "are you going deaf?" "Please forgive the override," a rather officious and unapologetic voice Gheorghe did not recognize said from the screen. "Am I talking to Chark Gavansa Jernau Morat Gheorghe Dam Hassiz?" Gheorghe stared dubiously at the screen eye. He hadn't heard his full name pronounced for years. "Yes?" "My name is Loash Amasko Yap Wuhandrahen Zeta Kum." Gheorghe raised one eyebrow. "Well, that should be easy enough to remember." "Might I interrupt you, sir?"
"You already have. What do you want?"
"To talk with you. Despite my override, this does not constitute an emergency, but I can only talk to you directly this evening. I am here representing the contact section at the request of Dastavev Chamlis Amoutne Ebhandra Te Dreiske Ostelhurup. May I approach you?"
"Providing you can stay off the full names, yes," Gheorghe said.
"I shall be there directly." Gheorghe snapped the screen shut. He tapped the pen-like terminal on the edge of the wooden table and looked out over the dark fjord, watching the dim lights of the few houses on the far shore. He heard a roaring noise in the sky and looked up to see a far-side lit vapor trail overhead, steeply angled and pointing to the slope uphill from Icro. There was a muffled bang over the forest above the house and a noise like a sudden gust of wind. Then, zooming round the side of the house, came a small drone, its fields bright blue and striped yellow. It drifted over toward Gheorghe. The machine was about the same size as Morinskell. It could, Gheorghe thought, have sat comfortably in the rectangular sandwich plate on the table. Its gunmetal casing looked a little more complicated and knobbly than Morinskell's. "Good evening," Gheorghe said, as the small machine cleared the terrace wall. It settled down on the table by the sandwich plate. "Good evening, Morat Gheorghe."
"Contact, eh?" Gheorghe said, putting his terminal into a pocket in his robe. "That was quick. I was only talking to Chamlis the night before last."
"I happened to be in the volume," the machine explained in its clipped voice. "In transit, between the GCU flexible demeanor and the GSV unfortunate conflict of evidence aboard the DROU Zealot. As the nearest contact operative, I was the obvious choice to visit you. However, as I say, I can only stay for a short time.
Oh, what a pity, Gergay said.
Yes, you have such a charming orbital here. Perhaps some other time.
Well, I hope it hasn't been a wasted journey for you, Loash.
I wasn't really expecting an audience with a contact operative. My friend Chamlis just thought contact might,
I don't know, have something interesting which wasn't in general circulation. I expected nothing at all, or just information.
Might I ask just what you're doing here? He leaned forward, putting both elbows on the table, leaning over the small machine. There was one sandwich left on the plate just in front of the drone. Gergay took it and ate, munching and looking at the machine.
Certainly. I'm here to ascertain just how open to suggestions you are. Contact might be able to find you something which would interest you.
A game?
I have been given to understand it is connected with a game.
That does not mean you have to play one with me, Gergay said, brushing his hands free of crumbs over the plate. A few crumbs flew toward the drone, as he'd hoped they might, but it fielded each one, flicking them neatly to the center of the plate in front of it.
All I know, sir, is that contact might have found something to interest you. I believe it to be connected with a game. I am instructed to discover how willing you might be to travel. I therefore assume the game, if such it is to be played in a location besides Chark.
Travel? Gergay said.
He sat back.
Where? How far? How long?
I don't know exactly.
Well, try, approximately.
I would not like to guess. How long would you be prepared to spend away from home?
Gergay's eyes narrowed. The longest he'd spent away from Chark had been when he'd gone on a cruise once, 30 years earlier. He hadn't enjoyed it especially. He'd gone more because it was the done thing to travel at that age than because he'd wanted to. The different stellar systems had been spectacular, but you could see just as good a view on a holoscreen, and he still didn't really understand what people saw in actually having been in any particular system. He'd planned to spend a few years on that cruise, but gave up after one. Gergay rubbed his beard.
Perhaps half a year or so. It's hard to say without knowing the details.
Say that, though. Say half a year. Not that I can see it's necessary. Local colour rarely adds that much to a game.
Normally true.
The machine paused.
I understand this might be a rather complicated game. It might take a while to learn. It is likely you would have to devote yourself to it for some time.
I'm sure I'll manage, Gergay said.
The longest it had taken him to learn any game had been 3 days. He hadn't forgotten any rule of any game in all his life, nor ever had to learn one twice.
Very well, the small drone said suddenly. On that basis, I shall report back. Farewell, Murat Gergay.
It started to accelerate into the sky. Gergay looked up at it, mouth open. He resisted the urge to jump up.
Is that it? He said.
The small machine stopped a couple of meters up.
That's all I'm allowed to talk about. I've asked you what I was supposed to ask you, now I report back. Why, is there anything else you would like to know I might be able to help you with?
Yes, Gergay said, annoyed now. Do I get to hear anything else about whatever and wherever it is you're talking about?
The machine seemed to waver in the air. Its feels hadn't changed since its arrival. Eventually it said,
Ajana Gergay?
There was a long moment when they were both silent. Gergay stared at the machine, then stood up, put both hands on his hips and his head to one side and shouted,
Yes? Probably not, the drone snapped, and instantly rose straight up, feels flicking off.
He heard the roaring noise and saw the vapor trail form. It was a single tiny cloud at first, because he was right underneath it. Then it lengthened slowly for a few seconds, before suddenly ceasing to grow. He shook his head. He took out the pocket terminal.
House, he said. Raise that drone.
He continued to stare into the sky.
Which drone, Jano? The house said. Chamlis?
He stared at the terminal.
No. That little scumbag from Contact, Loash Amasco Yap Wu Handran Zato Coom. That's who. The one who was just here.
Just here?
The house said in its puzzled voice. Gergay sagged. He sat down.
You didn't see or hear anything just now?
Nothing but silence for the last 11 minutes, Gergay, since you told me to hold all calls. There have been two of those since, but...
Never mind. Gergay sighed. Get me Hub.
Hub here. Michael Strabe, Mind Subsection. Journal Gergay, what can we do for you?
Gergay was still looking at the sky overhead, partly because that was where the contact drone had gone, the thin vapor trail was starting to expand and drift, and partly because people tended to look in the direction of Hub when they were talking to it. He noticed the extra star just before it started to move. The light point was near the trailing end of the little drone's far-side lit contrail. He frowned. Almost immediately it moved. Only moderately fast at first, then too quickly for the eye to anticipate. It disappeared. He was silent for a moment, then said, "Hub, has a contact ship just left here?"
"Doing so even as we speak, Gergé. The demilitarized rapid offensive unit..."
"Zealot," Gergé said.
"Oh-ho! It was you, was it? We thought it was going to take months to work that one out. You've just seen a private visit, game player Gergé. Contact business, not for us to know. Wow! Were we inquisitive, though? Very glamorous, Juno, if we may say so. That ship crash-stopped from at least 40 kilolights and swerved 20 years, just for a 5-minute chat with you, it would seem. That is serious energy usage, especially as it's accelerating away just as fast. Look at that kid go. Oh, sorry, you can't. Well, take it from us. We're impressed. Care to tell a humble hub mind subsection what it was all about?"
"Any chance of contacting the ship?" Gergé said, ignoring the question.
"Dragging away like that? Business end pointed straight back at a mere civilian machine like ourselves?"
The hub mind sounded amused.
"Yeah, we suppose so.
I want a drone on it called Loash Amasko Yap Wahandrahan Zeto Kum."
"Holy shit, Gergé. What are you tangling with here? Handrahan? Zeto? That's a Quivtec espionage-level SC nomenclature. Heavy messing. Shit. We'll try. Just a moment."
Gergé waited in silence for a few seconds.
"Nothing," the voice from the terminal said. "Gergé, this is Hub Entire speaking here, not a subsection, all of me. That ship's acknowledging, but it's claiming there's no drone of that name or anything like it aboard."
Gergé slumped back in the seat. His neck was stiff. He looked down from the stars, down at the table.
"You don't say," he said.
"Shall I try again?"
"Think it'll do any good?"
"No."
"Then don't."
"Gergé, this disturbs me. What is going on?"
"I wish," Gergé said, "I knew."
He looked up at the stars again. The little drone's ghostly vapor trail had almost disappeared. "Get me Chamlis and Maltenay, will you?"
"Online." "Jurna?"
"What, Hub?"
"Be careful."
"Oh, thanks. Thanks a lot."
"You must have annoyed it," Chamlis said through the terminal.
"Very likely," Gergé said. "But what do you think?"
"They were sizing you up for something."
"You think so?"
"Yes, but you just refused the deal."
"Did I?"
"Yes, and think yourself lucky you did, too."
"What do you mean? This was your idea."
"Look, you're out of it. It's over. But obviously my request went further and quicker than I thought it would. We triggered something, but you put them off. They aren't interested anymore."
"Hmm, I suppose you're right."
"Gergé, I'm sorry."
"Oh, never mind," Gergé told the old machine.
He looked up at the stars.
"Hub?"
"Hey, we're interested. If it had been purely personal, we wouldn't have listened to a word, we swear. And besides, it'd be notified on your daily communication statement we were listening."
"Never mind all that."
Gergé smiled, oddly relieved the orbital's mind had been eavesdropping. "Just tell me how far away that ROU is."
"On the word is, it was 1:49 away, a light month distant, already clear of the system and well out of our jurisdiction. We're very glad to say. Hightailing it in a direction a little upspin of galactic core. Looks like it's heading for the GSV unfortunate conflict of evidence, unless one of them's trying to fool somebody."
"Thank you, Herb. Good night."
"To you too. And you're on your own this time, we promise."
"Thank you, Herb. Chamlis?"
"You might just miss the chance of a lifetime, Gergé. But it was more likely a narrow escape. I'm sorry for suggesting contact. They came too fast and too hard to be casual."
"Don't worry so much, Chamlis," he told the drone.
He looked back at the stars again and sat back, swinging his foot up onto the table.
"I handled it. We managed." "Will I see you at Tron's tomorrow?"
"Maybe. I don't know. I'll think about it. Good luck. I mean against this wonder child at Stricken.
if I don't see you tomorrow.
He grinned ruefully into the darkness. Thanks. Good night, Chambliss.
Good night, Gergé.
The train emerged from the tunnel into bright sunlight. It banked round the remainder of the curve, then set out across the slender bridge. Gergé looked over the handrail and saw the lush green pastures and brightly winding river half a kilometre below on the valley floor. Shadows of mountains lay across the narrow meadows. Shadows of clouds freckled the tree-covered hills themselves. The wind of the train's slipstream ruffled his hair as he drank in the sweet, scented mountain air and waited for his opponent to return. Birds circled in the distance over the valley, almost level with the bridge. Their cries sounded through the still air, just audible over the windrush sound of the train's passing. Normally, he'd have waited until he was due in Trons that evening and go there underground, but that morning he'd felt like getting away from Ikaro. He'd put on boots, a pair of conservatively styled pants, and a short open jacket, then taken to the hill paths, hiking over the mountain and down the other side. He'd sat by the side of the old railway line, glanding a mild buzz, and amusing himself by chucking little bits of lodestone into the track's magnetic field and watching them bounce out again. He'd thought about Ye's floating islands. He'd also thought about the mysterious visitation from the contact drone on the previous evening, but somehow that just would not come clear. It was as though it had been a dream. He had checked the house communication and system statement. As far as the house was concerned, there had been no visit. But his conversation with Chark Hub was logged, timed and witnessed by other subsections of the Hub, and by the Hub entire for a short while. So it had happened all right. He'd flagged down the antique train when it appeared, and even as he'd climbed on,